Please excuse interruption. Your leader, Mr. Philip Shepherd, has just joined. Thank you, sir.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. We're a group of about 30 or so at the moment, and there may be some more people joining us as we go along. That will be noted in the record of discussion. I had circulated a brief agenda for today, and what I was really sort of planning on doing overall is doing sort of more of a planning and sort of quilting session, really, in looking at how we sort of perhaps stitch together the three reports that we have from our subgroups, and hope that in that process we can make perhaps an elegant patchwork quilt from those subgroup reports that have some structure and form to it, and I hope we won't end up stitching together something that looks like a Frankenstein monster. In a second, I think for the agenda, I was planning on having just each of the subgroup chairs or their substitutes giving an overview in terms of where their subgroups have got to, not a full treatise of the written reports, just about 5 minutes each on each of the subgroup reports A, B, and C. Then some brief discussion of some sort of parallel or tangential issues that have come out of some of those discussions, and relate to some of the overlap issues, and then looking at some ideas of going forward and how we start to structure putting these three things together in ways that are going to be digestible for us going forward. So that's the plan to do with the agenda. We should be on for about an hour or so. And if I may, I think first of all I'd like to thank all of our three subgroup chairmen very much for the work they put in a rather short period of time. I think we achieved some excellent results. So thank you very much to Steve Milson and to John. And perhaps on that, just taking them in order, Steve, if you could give us a quick sort of summary of where your group got to in its deliberations in about sort of speaking for right about 5 minutes or so.
Okay, thank you, Philip. I think subgroup A had made some progress as far as we got. I think we left a number of issues that we hadn't discussed in great detail, but we at least have a framework further. We identified that our task of defining roles, responsibilities, and requirements effect of the OPOC, since we were talking within the context of the OPOC proposal, really broke down into four major questions: who the OPOC is, what issues the OPOC is required to handle and what she's required to do, when must the OPOC act, and how would these responsibilities be enforced, and what happens if they're not fulfilled. And we had two main proposals that we drew from, one from Steve Del Bianco, one from Christopher Gibson, and it quickly became clear we were talking about three basic functions, which we defined in the report, at least to some degree: a relay function, a reveal function, and a remedy function. So the first one is communicating back and forth to the registrant via the OPOC. The second is the circumstances under which someone who makes a request is provided with the contact information on the registered name holder that's not part of, no longer be part of the publicly accessible list. And the third is remedying the problem, which could involve suspending the registration or making a site to the domain name resolves go dark or other changes to remedy a problem that's identified.
Right.
That was the basic framework that we used. I think we got farthest on the first couple of questions about who the OPOC would be, what capabilities it would have to have. In other words, the capabilities to carry out these functions.
Matt, sorry. Carry on, Steve.
Okay. What relationships it would have to have, both to the registered name holder, to the registrar, to ICANN. There was some discussion about whether OPOC should be accredited or whether by ICANN or whether simply the registrar would have some responsibilities to make sure that the OPOC listed was somebody who could carry out these functions. And then the what question, page 5 of the
Pardon, report, what, no, James.
Really helps to spell out the circumstances in which these different functions would be actuated, the relay function, the reveal function. I think the remedy function is probably the one we talked least about, beyond some level of agreement that it would be reserved only for really serious cases, such as a phishing situation. And we had some discussion about the time frames, how fast the OPOC would have to act. I don't think we reached any clear agreement on that, but the framework that we talked about on our last call is laid out in the report, and another proposal was received after our last call, and that is we have a link to that in the report. And finally, on enforcement, I think the general idea was there would need to be some type of backup if the OPOC failed to carry out its job, and likely that backup would be through the registrar, but there obviously could be some role for ICANN as an enforcer of last resort. There was also some discussion about overlap of what we did with both the other subgroups. First, the overlap with regard to the reveal function with the work of subgroup 2, and second, the overlap with regard to enforcement with the discussion in subgroup C regarding who really would be within the OPOC system. Would a registrant who was who was not a natural person or who was carrying out commercial activities even be designating an OPOC? And if that were the rule, then you would need to have some enforcement mechanism for registrants who improperly designated an OPOC rather than making their contact information available in who is. So within the time constraints, that's a brief summary of a rather somewhat rambling report, but I think we did make progress in some areas. There clearly are a number of areas that need further discussion.
Steve, no, thank you very much. I think the report actually made some very good progress, and particularly in the way that you categorized. I thought that was very helpful for us, and certainly identifying the overlap issues is a particular use for our work going forward. Milton, subgroup B.
Okay. Our subgroup was concerned, again, with which legitimate third parties may access registration data that might be shielded by the OPOC. We first developed a template so that people could make specific proposals as to how they wanted that problem to be solved. And we received ultimately 11 proposals, and those are all included along with our report. Basically, the discussion mostly ended up focusing on how to define or recognize legitimate third parties and on the question of what type of access those parties might receive. In terms of eligible third parties, we started out with a pretty firm, I think, and well-agreed distinction between public law enforcement agencies and others. We define what we mean by those in the report, but we thought that there was, in terms of a categorical distinction, that was the most fundamental one. And there was pretty good agreement that law enforcement agencies should be granted access to the data elements, although variation in views about how restrictive those conditions might be, there was no, I think, fundamental or principled objection to that. And we also felt that there might be some kind of a basic institutional framework in place for identifying who would be qualified to be classified as a public law enforcement agency, although that would need to be explored and examined in greater detail. And there was mention of Interpol and the National Agency's interface with Interpol in that regard. But when it came to private parties, of course, as you might expect, there was a lot more divergence of opinion. I think in some ways we were sidetracked a little bit by talking about who the private parties might be and people listing categories of private parties rather than what kinds of legitimate needs they might have and that would justify access, and how those needs would be vetted or identified. Anyway, we didn't make much progress on that. Most of the proposals from business constituencies proposed some form of self-certification and affidavit with some kind of ex post threat that access would be withdrawn under if there was an abuse of the access privileges. But there was no agreement on the merits of relying on self-certification. And this discussion of private parties was complicated by the fact that we had a couple of advocates of a special sectoral approach, in particular banks. There was certainly support for the idea that the phishing that targets banks is a problem that requires urgent attention. There was support for the view that the working group, however, should not necessarily devote its time to a sector-specific bank proposal. The good thing about the bank proposal is that it is possible to reliably certify what is a bank, at least within the U.S. legal framework, and probably in Europe and most developed countries as well. But most people thought that the solution that would encompass all legitimate private party users would be preferable. However, there was an alternate view that a proposal narrowly focused on banks could be used as a model or test case. I did actually make good progress in terms of identifying the different degrees of access that might be granted. And here's where the overlap takes place with subgroup A. We identified three basic kinds of access, four if you include the indirect access through governments. What we call type one access is restricted and incident-based. Access is limited to the records of particular domains and or registrants causing problems. A specific request is made to a gatekeeper for those domains. We note that this can't be provided by port 43, and this type of access could incorporate a two-tiered process in which a manual review gives certain entities access to an automated query screening process. Type 2 access we considered in which you have query-based access to any domain, but you are somehow contractually or legally restricted to making queries to the records of particular domains or registrants needed to support a specific investigation. And this would require some kind of auditing regarding which queries are made by users. And we recognize that there are special cases in which law enforcement agencies, the auditing rights had to be limited because of, say, national security or something like that. Type 3 access we classified as what we have now, and what we called type 4 access, which could be considered a special case of type 1, is indirect access by means of governments, where private parties obtain access to the shielded information through their government or some kind of agency designated by their government under national law. Now, after discussing these types of access, we agreed that law enforcement agencies, at the very least, should be granted type 1 access. There's support for granting them type 2 access, and an alternate view that they'd be granted type 3 access. With respect to private parties, the business users made it very clear that they favor the status quo in WHOIS, but going to go with the recommendation, there's agreement that private parties should not be granted type 3 access. And there was basically an equal division between participants who support giving private parties some kind of type 1 access, while others support giving them type 2 access. Now, note that type 1 access could be provided through what subgroup A calls a reveal mechanism. In other words, you're basically making a request of an OPOC, and the OPOC is then giving you the shielded contact details. Also, I noticed in your agenda, Phil, that you mentioned tiered access as possibly a separate agenda item. I would think that most of what we were talking about in this subgroup would classify as various flavors of or variants of tiered access.
And in fact, it was really overlap issues of tiered access I was coming to there. So I think, and some of those indeed you've identified.
Yeah. Okay. So the tiered access group gave us a report very late in our deliberations, and I submitted it to the group, but it's not really, wasn't discussed by us. The tiered access group is maybe something you want to explain later. Do you want me to explain who that is now?
Say who it is now, why not?
That was a group formed around the initiative, I think, of VeriSign and some registries, but included most other stakeholders except perhaps for the privacy advocates. And they discussed the mechanisms and the practical issues associated with delivering tiered access. They didn't reach any conclusions either, but they have a report that's a pretty good sort of description of the landscape of the problem. So I forwarded it to our group, but we didn't really discuss it. I think that's all.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Now, subgroup C, I think John is not with us because he's traveling, if I recall correctly.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. So then let me do my best to sum up where C got to. To some extent, C had one of the easier jobs in its sort of scoping the issue, and I think came up with a couple of interesting conclusions. I mean, C was charged with a question: should a distinction be made between the registration contact information published based either on the nature of the registered name holder or the use of the domain name? And I think going down that road, they made some useful distinction between concept of natural or legal persons, natural being real people, legal persons typically being organizations of some form, and commercial or non-commercial activities. And the distinction there, of course, was that a natural legal person is a historic fact about the nature of the registrant, whereas the second distinction to do with commercial or non-commercial activities, for example, is more difficult because it relates to things like the future intent of use of the domain name, and therefore already assuming that there will be a website based on that domain name. On the basis of those discussions, it was generally agreed, I think, by the group that certainly making the distinction between natural legal persons had much greater simplicity and areas of ease of verification, and had a certain sense in that there was a connection to between natural persons and data protection legislation, typically found in many legislations, where of course data protection legislation is normally focused on legal persons, real people, and therefore privacy of data is typically focused on that area. And on that basis, they came up with one option which I think had produced a reasonable agreement within the group, which was that in the case of legal persons, that is, organizations, there should be full disclosure of the data, i.e., as we have today, and only in the case of natural persons should there be the concept of retained disclosure of data. The group then also discussed if it was possible to make such distinctions with commercial and non-commercial activities. Prior to that, they had, I think, also recognized that the simplest way for distinction to be made should be by self-declaration by the registrant at the time of registration. So there was a trust issue in terms of how the registrant was declaring. So on the second item, looking at the idea of whether or not distinction can be made between commercial and non-commercial activities, and there was a list of various things that could be used to help define whether or not commercial activity is taking place, such as offer of sale of goods or services, solicitation of extra money, marketing activities, and so forth. And on that basis, there was a further grid produced, which was still linking back to the concept of legal persons and natural persons as well, and then saying, and what happens if those people are engaged in either commercial activities or non-commercial activities, and a matrix come out of that in terms of how disclosure of who his data set should look. But it has to be said that there was recognition on the group that this was much more problematic in terms of describing, verifying, and also recognizing that even if it's true one day, it may well change to the next. Finally, I think the group recognized that in the case of data that was either declared and it was inaccurate through either good intent and inefficiency or bad intent, and there should be some sort of challenge procedure, and they recognize that linked back to the sort of activity that was happening in working group A. So again, my thanks to the chairs for doing those. What I wanted to talk about now, and just ask some questions of the group as a whole, is relating to some of the sort of side issues that have come up from that. And I just listed on the agenda three things that I thought that had come up that had some relevance, which are proxies, what would be the future fate of the admin and tech context, and the linkage in particular between subgroups A and B in relating to ad hoc requests for full Whois data. Perhaps it may be useful to take those in reverse order, since it's much more logical from the reports we've just heard. And I just wanted to air the thought that as we try to put all these three ideas together, would it make sense to always think about integrating the for ad hoc requests, that's one-off requests for data, integrating the work that came out of the subgroup B on tiered access with the mechanisms that were being discussed for those sort of queries within subgroup A? My feeling was that sort of yes, that seemed to make sense, whereas access to bulk data, i.e. sort of, you know, either the whole data set or a limited part of it, as Milton described, seemed to have a different flavor to it, and therefore a different process could be structured for that. So does that thought make sense, your comments on that?
Phil, I guess I'll take up the gauntlet.
Okay, Milton, let me just take a list. See who else wants to talk. Who else?
This is Steve. Could I get in the queue?
Steve, yep. Who else? Okay, gentlemen. Off you go, Milton.
Yeah, I think there's a natural intersection here. That is, the operational point of contact ideally should be somebody who is in a good position to reveal the shielded data. And the issue that we ran into, again, and which there's no easy solution to, is how does this person determine request? This would be dissatisfied with a system in which the OPOC simply gets a request and says, oh, here's the so-called private data. And then other people, you know, who are constantly trying to fight lawbreakers are going to be concerned about a situation which makes that into a month-long process. So we need to have a clear criteria, but clearly, since port 43 does not provide any authentication mechanism, that a manual process that works through the OPOC and is, you know, sufficiently guided and protected so that it only reveals the data under the proper circumstances, I think is one of the big solutions to providing type 1 access.
Okay. Thank you for that. Steve.
I think just picking up on what Milton's last comment, I think this is kind of the type 1 access that was discussed in Group B. We made a stab in Subgroup A at kind of sharpening this to identify what types of activity we were talking about, and we borrowed from the Registrar Accreditation Agreement to use a phrase that that a request about one of these issues would have to be accompanied by reasonable evidence of wrongful registration use or activity. This is all in a definition that was actually in Chris Gibson's proposal about request raising legal issues, what that means. And so presumably there would be some requests that didn't qualify, and those would not have, at least not right away, at least they reveal function. But those that did qualify, the OPOC would would make that determination and reveal the data. Again, this is based on something in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement now that's applicable to, well...
Steve, you're fading in and out. Are you moving away from your phone or something?
No, I'm not, but I'll try to keep my voice up. Just to say that we borrowed that phrase, reasonable evidence of actionable harm, is the phrase that's now in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement. I think it was kind of flagged in Paul Stahura's must-may document that he circulated to this working group even before the subgroups were started.
Okay, that's helpful. And the other question I had also was, would it be reasonable to have a different test or different reaction to an individual inquiry that's concerning the accuracy of the who is data that's displayed versus alleged legal activity on the website, and does that help us also perhaps in the mechanisms there?
Well, I thought we were just talking about access to the shielded who is the contact information, the address.
It's a reason. So my question wasn't clear enough, and it was a reason behind asking access for that.
And if
we're simply saying, "Hey, look, the Huawei data seems to be accurate. I'm sure this person is really a company," for instance, or you know, this email address doesn't seem to be correct. Versus, I don't like what they're doing on their website, and should the test, if you like, or the mechanism be different?
Well, I thought we already had a mechanism for challenging the accuracy of Huawei's data.
Yes, we do, an existing mechanism. Yes, I mean, that's the question is more broader than should there be any change to that, merely, perhaps it's merely that process would go via an OPOC in the future if that's the way things turn out.
Milton, could I get in the queue on that?
Yes, Steve, indeed. Yeah, anybody else also? Okay, off you go, Steve.
I think in the OPOC environment, that issue of challenging the accuracy of Whois data becomes somewhat irrelevant because there isn't much Whois data that's made publicly accessible. I guess the two areas where you might still need to be concerned about that are, first, if subgroup C's approach is taken and you have someone who should be revealing their full Whois data, full data in Whois, but who's falsely claiming to be a non-commercial natural person registrant, you need to have some mechanism for challenging that. And I guess the other thing is, if you have someone listed as an OPOC and their contact data is incomplete, or they don't list an email address or something, or if you have a system of accrediting OPOCs and it's an unaccredited entity that's listed as the OPOC, that would be, you would need some procedure for challenging that. I think both of those are really, I don't think anybody would be challenging these just on the basis of inaccuracy alone. Their reason for challenging it would be that in order to facilitate their access to the shielded data, as Milton referred to it.
Yeah.
So, but I think these are two cases in which you would need to have some type of challenge procedure, I suppose.
I'm still a little bit puzzled by this. Now, let's assume for the moment that we are, in fact, only dealing with natural persons. Forget about non-commercial. I don't think there's any consensus on that. But natural persons takes a huge load off of this whole problem, right? Because that means that 75% of the registrations are going to be supposed to have full unshielded Whois data, right? They're going to be legal persons, and there's no reason for them not to reveal that. And I think I can get, everybody that I know behind that, as opposed to the non-commercial distinction, which is a morass and a swamp. But again, assuming that the natural persons are the only ones that are shielded, then if you're challenging the status of someone as a natural person, that is indeed a challenge to the accuracy of the who is record, isn't it? There's some little box on there that says this is a natural person, and you're challenging that. So why couldn't the existing procedure be used? I don't agree with you, Steve, that the shielded OPOC who is contains not enough information to concern with accuracy. I think that the name and jurisdictions, states and country are going to be critical things, and if the name turns out to be something that is clearly unrelated to the domain in some way, I think that's a basis for a challenge. Or if the OPOC is some made-up address, which, if they make up their own address, they'll do that with the OPOC too if there's some kind of a fraudulent registrant. So I think there's plenty to go with, and I don't think we want to be creating new procedures unless we really, really have to. I mean, life is complicated enough.
Okay. That's been very useful. Let's just move on to one of the other items I mentioned, which is proxies. And so the first open question really is, should we be bothered about proxies? Now, reasons that you might be would be that supposing we do have a world following the subgroup C suggestions, now if you're a legal person and you want to have shielded display of your data, you would opt for a proxy service. But if we're now loading an OPOC in terms of a certain set of responsibilities in terms of how they would react, do we need to have a more formal specification of who a proxy could be? At the moment, I understand a proxy can be the registrar or reseller or indeed sometimes somebody even further remote. And would it make sense for that proxy to be only an ICANN accredited registrar, for instance? Comments on that?
I would like to have a comment for that.
Who's I?
It's Tom. Sorry.
Tom. Who else?
Andrew Denholm.
Did you say your name again? Sorry.
Andrew.
Yeah. Who else? Okay, Tom, off you go for the moment.
Yes, thank you. Well, one thing in regard to proxies I want to mention is that we have two different types of experience right now in terms of proxy services. One is proxy services that are being offered by registrars on a big scale, which certainly could be dealt with in one way or another. Other thing I see is that, for example, solicitors or other business people taking on the role of a proxy for customers that don't want to reveal who they are. And I guess this is a type of business that we cannot regulate, however hard we try. I think we would even be
breaking a certain law. Because that's outside of ICANN's capability, essentially, because if you're choosing to have your solicitors putting that name down for you, then,
of question whether you could regulate any kind of business conducting this this method, even if they're related to a registrar. So you might be able to impose something on registrars, which I hope we won't do. But just imagine that some new company is founded and registrars are just referring to them, I don't think that we have as ICANN have the measures with the policies to tackle that at all. So I think the whole discussion about whether we want it or why not is pretty moot.
Okay. Andrew.
Yes, I was just going to say the same. If we need to find somebody who's got inappropriate IP material on there or something like that, isn't that just adding an extra hurdle? It's going to be difficult to overcome.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that comment.
I'm looking at this from the point of view of the bank. So if we want to try to have intellectual property removed or something like that, isn't a proxy going to make it just have an extra hurdle that's going to make it much more difficult to get behind whoever's got whoever owns the site?
Oh yes, it is. But I mean, the status quo is that proxies exist today, and there was nothing in the existing OPOC proposal to say that they should go away. So my question is does the whole existence of proxies drive a truck through the things we're trying to set up in terms of responsibilities of the OPOC? Is sort of behind that earlier question.
Apologies.
I think you're raising the same issue in a separate way, whereas Tom was saying it's going to happen anyway, so there's not much you can do about it.
Milton, this is Steve. Could I get in the queue, please?
Steve, anybody else in the queue?
Adam Scoville.
Adam, and sorry, who else besides Adam?
Susan Calgucci.
Susan.
And okay. Margie Milam.
And Margie. Anybody else?
Yeah, Ken Stubbs, please go on.
Ken. Okay, I'll do it in a moment. Steve, off you go.
Just to say that this was discussed to some extent in subgroup A. There were some who took the view that with the OPOC system, there really it wasn't any more role for proxy services. I think we looked at the must-may document that was circulated, which seemed to indicate that the registrant could be a proxy service. That could be the registered name holder, and then you'd have to go through another step, as Andrew was saying. And there was another view, I guess, that if proxy services continued to exist, there needs to be some way to get at the identity of the actual registrant, if you will. And I would point out that one thing that we looked at in the OPOC capabilities was that the OPOC would have to have the actual current contact data of the registrant. And, of course, sometimes proxy services may or may not have that. Certainly registrars may or may not have that. And therefore that was an important point, whether it was done by a proxy or done by the OPOC. There had to be some reliable way to pass on a request and, if necessary or under the appropriate circumstances, reveal accurate contact data.
Okay. Excellent. Adam.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sort of in some ways, a technical comment responding to the first commenter's sort of query as to whether ICANN could venture in to regulate proxies, particularly in a situation where, say, it's a less formal proxy service, such as I own a domain and I have my sister be my proxy. You know, we currently do that in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, of course, Section 3.7.7.3, you know, says that if a registered name holder intends to, in the words of the RIA, license use of the domain to a third party, it's nonetheless the registered name holder and has to put its own information in. And it also says that the registered name holder licensing use of a registered name according to this provision shall accept liability for harm caused by wrongful use of the registered name unless it promptly discloses the identity of the licensee to a party providing the registered name holder reasonable evidence of actionable harm. So, you know, in essence, ad hoc sort of situation, the someone who's holding a domain for me still has an obligation to give up my information when presented with reasonable evidence of actionable harm.
Right. The first part of 3773 you said was that
any registered name holder that intends to license use of a domain name to a third party is nonetheless the registered name holder of record and is responsible for providing its own full contact information and for providing and updating accurate technical and administrative contact information adequate to facilitate timely resolution of any problems that arise in connection with the registered name.
So what does that mean in terms of the way the WHOIS records look today, then, if you're...
As I understand this, if a proxy service puts its own name in the WHOIS, it is considered the registered name holder. And there may be a beneficial holder that, by analogy, it's almost as if the proxy is a trustee and the real owner, so to speak, is the beneficiary of that trust-like relationship. In any event, the title owner to that domain is the proxy. It has to put its own information, and it has certain obligations for its ability to facilitate timely resolution of problems.
All right. Okay, so either... So the operator proxy today means either there may be questions about the application of that particular article or questions in terms of ownership that
Okay. Yeah, and that ownership may have consequences under national law, and yeah. This is a good mechanism in that it sort of defers things to national law. If national law says, you know, the person who owns a domain name, you know, is going to be responsible for what the content is, then that we let national law make that decision, and this just sort of defers to that. But it says whoever's in the who is for these purposes considered the owner or the registered name holder of the domain.
Okay, thanks for that, Susan.
Well, I'm probably just going to be echoing Steve and Adam's comments, but from our perspective, we need a standardized process for all proxy services to follow. Because if you're trying to get someone, you know, that registered name owner to, you know, the proxy service to reveal the information to be able to contact somebody, a bad player, then each and every proxy service seems to do it a little differently, which takes a lot of time on our part. So if I could establish a standardized process for revealing that information or at least contacting the actual owner, then these proxy services were bound to abide by that process, then that would make everybody a little bit happier, I think, out.
Okay. And if we're asking ICANN to do that, given that ICANN's relationship is only, in this case, with the registrars, would that imply that your preference would be that if there is a proxy service in operation, then it is the accredited registrar's information who's appearing in that who is record?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Margie?
One of the comments I wanted to make was regarding the whole register fly situation, and I think that's kind of highlighted a lot of the problems related to proxies and being able to get information behind the proxy. So I believe there are a number of registrars that do think there may be a role for some sort of rules or regulations related to proxies, at least the proxies that are the companies offering the service. I believe Paul Sahura, I don't know if he's on the line right now, has made comments to the effect that, you know, it probably makes sense to take a look at that. The register fly situation in particular seems to highlight the need for looking at that.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. Ken. Ken Stubbs.
I apologize. A couple of issues, Philip. First of all, I don't think it's possible for ICANN to regulate proxy services that are being offered outside of those under the registrar accreditation agreement, and I'm afraid what we may end up doing is creating a process that puts more of these types of companies into business. Number two is, if you read 3773 closely, you have the last sentence, which basically you have to provide reasonable evidence of actionable harm. And from a legal standpoint, I'm not a lawyer, but first of all, you've got words like reasonable, and number two, actionable by who? So I think what you're creating is a process here that, if anything, may cause a further delay, because one might argue that either the evidence is not reasonable or the harm, the person who's claiming the actionable harm doesn't necessarily have legitimate standing other than their own representation. So I'm just saying that from a practical standpoint, we need to try to provide a process here where the end result is one that's manageable within a reasonable time frame once it's determined that the person who is requesting the information, in fact, has the right to it. That's
sure. Given, supposing we had a world in which legal person's data was not fully displayed and there was protection there, would you be comfortable with the idea that the role of proxies, therefore, was redundant and didn't need to continue? Is that what you're saying in terms of clarity and simplicity or not?
No, what I'm saying is that if you're not careful, you're going to end up in a situation where people are going to start forming companies to provide the
right.
pre-registration process so that a registrar will have, let's say, one client who has 200,000-400,000 names in which they're listed as the proxy for those names, and
if I was a registrar, I'd look you in the eye and say, information I have is accurate. You're
okay.
going to have to go to this proxy, and you're just injecting another entity into the process, and you're right back where you started.
Right. So the other side of the coin of the of tightening up the responsibilities of an OPOC would be a business opportunity for massive proxy services if people didn't like the OPOC and still wanted things to be hidden.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what I'm saying is you have to offer people incentives that encourage them to provide legitimate information at the level closest for practicality. If you make the process too difficult, they'll just, you know, we're dealing with very creative people in this space. We all know that. So I'm just trying to avoid that.
Okay. Thanks, sir. We've just got about sort of 5-10 minutes left. Let's just touch on the other outstanding sort of tangential issue, which is admin and tech contacts. This is being raised on one or other, which now. And it also just struck me looking at sort of what a future data set may look like if we're adding on OPUC data. That largely the role of admin and tech could, or one option would be for that to be subsumed by the OPOC for simplicity, and indeed there's already the possibility for having a more than one OPOC. The only concern against that, I think, seemed to be about the possibility of the whole new system not working and wanting to roll back to the past. Are there views on the future necessity of admin and tech? It just strikes me that administering a database in which you might have up to 5 separate contacts with the domain name and as a user having to put all that information in, as a supplier having to keep all that data, strikes me as burdens we could probably do without. But that may just be me in my simple way. Comments on that issue?
This is Steve Metallitz. Can I get in the queue?
Steve, who else?
Milton.
Milton, who else?
Vault.
Vault, who else? Okay, I'll do this. Vault, let me take you first if you haven't spoken yet.
Okay, thank you. I'll keep this very brief and I won't go into details, but it's information that we as LEA use, and it also works for us to help find spammers. I think that would be as brief as possible.
Okay, but that's today, though. But I mean, presuming that tomorrow we would have an OPOC contact there instead, and maybe with certain responsibilities in terms of reacting to your request, would that not do the job?
We don't know. That's the problem. We know what we have. That's simple.
That's very practical. Yeah. Okay. Steve.
I would echo his the last point made. This is today important information for contacting registrants. Sometimes the registrant information, which is not that detailed anyway, is insufficient to accomplish the task. So we would not want to see that eliminated, at least without some pretty secure guarantees about what the OPOC would do if instead.
Right. Okay. So it's conditional upon, as I was saying, conditional upon what OPOC would end up looking like and having to do. All right. Milton.
Yeah, I thought that one of the whole points of OPOC was to be a consolidation of the administrative and technical contact, and that the reason we proposed doing that was that people were completely confused about what the difference between the two was and did not systematically differentiate between the two. There's really almost no... I know in the case, for example, of my registration of the Convergence Center's domain, I just sort of didn't know what to put for the administrative contact or the technical contact. So for the technical contact, I put our IT department. This guy probably knows nothing about what's going on our domain most of the time. And the admin tech, I put myself, but the university's address. I mean,
It's not clear what you do, and the OPOC has to be a consolidated, simpler mechanism of doing that. So I'm not sure why anybody would want to retain admin and tech. I think it would make things a lot clearer if OPOC was what you put in there.
Okay. Useful puzzles. What I'll do now, if I just may, is under items 3 and 4 of the agenda, which are two sides of the same idea, really, is just to propose a work item, which is going to be a work item for Maria as ICANN staff, in terms of putting all the work that's gone to subgroups together. And my first thoughts were that maybe a way to look at what are likely to be areas of agreement and also for understanding in terms of how things would work would be to sort of structure it as to, you know, how might a post-OPOC world look like, presuming everything works as intended. So there's good faith in terms of declared data by the registrant, there's efficiency in terms of the way that system is operating, and how will that look first? And then there's a second stage to say, well, okay, now we've got the what-if questions. What if, indeed, there's bad faith? What if there's inefficiency? What if there are mistakes? And then how do we start to handle those queries in the sort of way that subgroup A's task came in? So just your immediate thoughts, if there's any downside to structuring things in that way. My feeling is it might allow us just to see a thread through a system of how that would all look like, and then allow us to address some of those areas and identify do a gap analysis, identifying those areas that still need to be answered. People generally comfortable with that as an approach for the next draft we see putting these three ports together?
Philip, this is Dan. Can I
start? Got Dan. Anybody else? Okay, Dan, off you go.
But when I read this for the first time, the first thing that occurred to me was that without some very good incentives, we have to assume in the bad faith situation, because there are enough bad actors out there that we're going to have to deal with it. And you know, if everyone acted in good faith, I think we wouldn't have a whole lot of problems in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and also, I think there's a certain circularity in the sense that if there are incentives for good faith, then you're more likely to have it, and therefore, depending on what the actual structure is of what we would propose, that would have an effect on the balance of what we would see in terms of good faith and bad faith in reality.
Yep, I think that's probably very true. Other thoughts on that before we close? Yep, okay. What I propose to do is I will, based on our discussion today, which I think has been very, very helpful, work with Maria and see what we can come up with in terms of first step at integrating these reports and using where we've already got areas of suggested areas of support and agreement with the language in the charter to some of these issues and identifying clearly those areas where there is ideas that aren't supported or indeed where there are ideas that need to be further discussed in order for opinion to be made. So we will try to have that done, I guess, in a week, so we have something to look at for next week's call. Does that make sense in terms of the timetable for you, Maria?
It certainly does. At least we can have a very solid working draft.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I think we'll probably all we would need going on, and that would obviously earlier the better, but we understand that you know, it's the first attempt at that's going to be the most difficult probably, and then we'll be refining that as we go on.
Philip, is the call going to be at the same time next Wednesday?
Probably. Just looking at a sort of timescales across the globe, this is about the best balance for for most time zones. I know it's a bit early West Coast USA, but then it's a bit late in the Far East and Australasia. So it's probably going to be about the same time.
Well, I guess 2 points. One, I'm not sure who on the call is here from the Far East and Australasia, but it is very early for the West Coast people, and I salute those of them who got up very early for this. And second, whatever the time is, let's try to get that sent out as a notice as soon as possible so we can plan our schedules. And I hope we'll have some time to review Maria's work product before the call.
Okay. So, well, then I think
Philip, one question on that. This is Adam. Just has there been any attempt to sort of poll what our distribution in fact is? I'm not sure that I've heard anyone who I know of offhand is coming from Australasia. If we don't have a whole lot of folks who are interested in that, then perhaps we could shift it. Even an hour would probably be helpful, or an hour or an hour and a half would be helpful to folks on the West Coast.
Okay, I'll get staff to look at the list and pass a bit of work that's there. We never quite know how these things are work. And the fact that there aren't people on from the Far East and Australia may simply be because I think it's far too bloody late anyway, and we're in bed, as opposed to lack of interest, and that they are upset by not being accommodated. So we obviously need to look at that as well, because clearly we are making decisions with a global impact. But the point is well taken. So on that note, I'll close the call today, and thank you all very much for your contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.